from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago, we wanted to weep when news came rushing from Sandy Hook Elementary School that 20 children, little children, were shot dead in school, point blank, along with six of their teachers. Even this nation, a nation with way too much experience with mass shootings, was stunned, brought to its knees emotionally. Now we're coming on the anniversary, Saturday, of that awful day. In a way, nothing has changed. Or maybe a lot is changing slowly. This hour on Point, how Newtown has coped, and the nation's long, hard conversation about this grief and guns and our culture. You can join the conversation on air or online. Did you think this time the world national policy would change? What have you seen, felt in this year since the terrible shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It was a year ago Saturday, here right after the tragedy. Melissa Mikoris, mother of a child who was in school during the shooting, telling an NPR reporter what her son had told her.
He heard loud noises, loud voices. He heard snapping, is what he described. And he said that the gym teachers scooted them right away from the doors and into a corner, and they had to sit there very, very quietly. And some policemen came in and said that they were going to get out of the building and they needed to run.
Her son heard snapping. It was more than snapping. So many would die. In the chaos after here was a father of a student at Sandy Hook describing to MSNBC his reaction to hearing about the shooting.
I could try to explain it, but I'm sure I would fail. There's no words that I could come up with that would even come close to describing the sheer terror of hearing that your son is in a place, or your child is in a place, where there's been violence. You don't know the details of that violence. You don't know the condition of your child, and you can't do anything to immediately help them or protect them. It is a powerless and terrifying experience.
But we would learn. We would learn just how bad it was. 20 students, 6 teachers, Adam Lanza, the killer. Joining me now from New York is Lisa Miller, contributing editor at New York Magazine. She spent a lot of time this fall in Newtown looking at how the community has coped and evolved since the shooting 1 year ago this Saturday. You can read her story, Orders of Grief. There's a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Lisa Miller, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Hartford, Connecticut, we're joined by Reverend Josh Pollack, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut. We had Reverend Pollack with us just after the shooting last year to talk about the massacre and its impact on people in and around Newtown. Josh Pollack, Reverend Pollack, thank you very much for being with us again 1 year on.
And thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
Lisa, let me come first to you. I mean, we have seen bits and pieces. We've seen delegations of parents from Newtown showing up in Washington and all over the country in this last year. We know there was a huge response from the country to the point that they said, you know, please no more teddy bears and all the rest. You spent time in this community. How is it dealing with the immensity of the tragedy there?
The thing you have to remember about Newtown is that it's a very small place. 26,000 people live there, mm-hmm. Newtown and Sandy Hook combined. And so what that means is when 26 people are shot, everybody knows somebody that it happened to. And you can't get away from it. The ghosts of the people who were killed that day are everywhere. They're in the shopping malls. They're in the grocery store. They're in the restaurants. The school is in the middle of town, the school that has been razed. The firehouse where the parents had to go and see if their children were living or dead is on a main thoroughfare, and you drive past it all the time.
Yeah.
There is this sense of it being very real. Even now, very contemporary, it is hard to escape it.
26 bronze stars on top of that local firehouse, one for each adult and child gunned down that day. Green ribbons, the color of the elementary school, were the color. They still, I read, are mailed to tied to mailboxes and storefronts. When you went, were people willing to talk about it? Or, you know, this week they're saying, please, please, mega media, please just leave us alone.
I mean, this is, it's something that we have to remember. You know, when we're watching the television news, when we're listening to the radio, we hear the phrase, the families. The families feel this. The families are that. The families are dealing it with it this way. But in fact, it's 26 very different families, and they're dealing with their grief and their horror in very different ways. And so what you find is that some families find it cathartic, helpful to talk about it, and they will talk to me. They did talk to me. Some families find that, you know, talking about it does not help, and they don't want to, and they refuse, and they haven't talked to any reporters or any press. Some families go on TV. Some families perform, you know, at the Lincoln Memorial on the Martin Luther King celebration. Everybody has a very different way of coping with this thing that's uncopable. And so when you go there, you find that people are extremely different in their grief, and yet it's all grief and it's all hard.
We're left to listen and imagine. We're going to look at policy changed and unchanged in so many ways a year later, but we want to just have a sense of this community first, with respect for the losses that it took. And here we were a year ago. This was 3 days after the killing. Krista Rico is talking with ABC News after her six-year-old daughter, Jessica, had died in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting.
It's still not real that my little girl, who's so full of life and who wants a horse so badly and who's going to get cowgirl boots for Christmas, isn't coming home.
The little girl who was going to get cowgirl boots for Christmas wasn't coming home. This week, Newtown selectman Patricia Lodra asked the media to honor the community's suffering during this year's anniversary by staying away.
We were fully aware of our tragedy, so we're trying to say to the world, please give us the chance to grow into that really happy, healthy place that loves children and families, that has great schools. We know who we are. We know that that's our destiny, but we need you to help us get there by please staying away.
Reverend Pollock, you're maybe an hour up the road from Newtown and Sandy Hook.
Yep.
We spoke with you when this was all so fresh and still unbelievable. Now we've all learned we have to believe it happened. What have you felt coming out of this community and in the larger Connecticut community surrounding Newtown as everyone has tried to take this on board?
Tom, I feel a real palpable tension around the need to respect the privacy of the families, of the people of Newtown, and particularly, you know, the people who have said, we don't want the media coming in. And at the same time, there's a really strong need to continue to talk about what happened, to continue to talk about violence in our culture. For the whole year, it's been a really fine line. I think I see a lot of frustration when the families and the victims in this massacre keep getting held up to make political arguments and to push political legislation, when in some ways it's so much more than laws needing to change. There's something deep in our culture that needs to change. And I think we're still getting a handle on it at this point.
I want to look at exactly that, and we will. Lisa, the kinds of attention that this community got were many, sometimes, I mean, garish, you know, NASCAR memorializing victims with a special car at the Daytona 500 and, 4,000 free tickets to Yankees games, I suppose appreciated, and yet the losses were so personal. How has the community dealt with the many stripes of national response and outreach to them?
Right. I mean, think about it. This terrible thing happens in your town. And it happens to everybody. I mean, it happens to 26 people, but it also happens to everybody.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, 63,000 teddy bears are coming to town. That is, you have to hire people to deal with 63,000 teddy bears. And $20 million came to town. And the town immediately, in the midst of their grief and trauma, had to figure out, you know, who gets the teddy bears? Where do we store the teddy bears? Who gets the money? Who is the money intended for? Is it intended for the victims' families, or is it intended for the town long term? Mm-hmm. There were all of these debates over it over the ensuing months. There is this sense that you have to prioritize the grief, like who's grieving more, who has more need, who's whose loss is greater, whose long-term needs are greater. Mm. And it's very hard to have these conversations in a productive and careful way when everybody is also so torn apart. And so the town, you know, I spent a lot of time there, and all of the people I met were sort of good people that you would like to meet over dinner, who you would want to have a conversation with. But they all took sort of different stances toward these issues, depending on where they stood. You know, were they a town leader? Were they a family who lost a child? Were they a person who lost a parent? Were they a parent of a child who was in the school that day but didn't get killed? You know, whose needs are most? Whose needs now are most? Whose needs long-term are most? It's a terrible conversation to have to have.
We hear about marriages where there's a terrible loss and they often fall apart. Would you describe this community as pulling together, falling apart, searching?
I think it's searching. You know, Pat Lodra, who's the selectman there, is a very, very impressive person. And, you know, as you heard from the clip just now, what she wants to say is this is a terrible thing that happened and we need to grieve and then move forward and be the town that Newtown is, which is a place where people move for good schools and, you know, good sports teams. But on the other hand, there's 26 families that may never actually recover from this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, talking this hour about grief and guns and more. 1 year after the Sandy Hook school shootings, the long, hard conversation propelled again by Newtown's nightmare. What has happened and what has not happened in the year since that terrible day? Lisa Miller is with us from New York Magazine. She's spent a lot of time in Newtown, Sandy Hook, written about it in depth. Reverend Josh Pollack is with us from Manchester, Connecticut, up the road from Newtown. This week, parent Jennifer Hensel, who with her husband Jeremy lost their daughter at the school last year, told NPR's Morning Edition she found it hard to comprehend still why this had happened.
Why would somebody do this? It's unfathomable. Why would somebody want to kill my child? Why would somebody want to kill as many as they possibly could? The question was why.
Unanswerable. On Monday, Newtown parent Ann Bacon said those looking to help should focus on their own communities.
We ask that you consider performing an act of kindness or volunteering with a charitable organization in your own local community. We hope that some small measure of good may be returned to the world.
Do an act of kindness, the recommendation there out of Newtown. But in the weeks and days after the shooting a year ago, the ambitions were much higher. In comments to reporters the day of the shooting, President Obama listed the many recent mass killings and said the country had to come together to figure out how to stop all this.
As a country, we have been through this too many times. Whether it's an elementary school in Newton or a shopping mall in Oregon or a temple in Wisconsin or a movie theater in Aurora or a street corner in Chicago, these neighborhoods are our neighborhoods. And these children are our children. And we're going to have to come together and take meaningful action to prevent more tragedies like this, regardless of the politics.
Regardless of the politics, maybe nothing is regardless of politics when you come to policy like that. Robert Spitzer joins us right now from Ithaca, New York, professor of political science at State University of New York at Cortland, visiting faculty member at Cornell, leading expert on gun control and the NRA. Member of both the Brady Center and the NRA, has written extensively about all of this, author of the forthcoming Guns Across America, and author of The Politics of Gun Control. Robert Spitzer, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here today. What's happened on the gun policy front in the year since this terrible shooting?
Tom, good to be with you. Actually, a great deal has been going on. Last December and January, President Obama, of course, tried to marshal political forces to win enactment of new gun measures in Congress. There were hearings, much debate in Congress and in the country. In April, some votes were taken on measures in the U.S. Senate. None of those measures passed muster, obtained 60 votes, which was required to enact legislation then in the Senate. Nothing happened in the House of Representatives. So the verdict would seem to be that, well, nothing happened. But in fact, there's been great activity someplace else, and that's in the American states. Virtually all of the 50 states have enacted some kind of gun measure, measure related to gun policy in the past 11 or 12 months. At least a dozen states have enacted measures to strengthen gun laws. More states have enacted measures to weaken gun laws in various respects. And that was clearly a response to the public outrage and attention focused on the gun issue. So a lot has been happening in the states this past year.
If nothing happened at the federal level, if a lot of states took it up but more loosened gun laws than tightened them, from a gun control perspective, could you say that Newtown has, if that's your perspective, has it improved the situation in this country on gun violence?
Well, that's a fair question. It depends on your perspective, obviously. From the gun rights perspective, there's a widespread belief that gun laws really don't do very much or don't do anything. And there's also belief that guns in the hands of civilians can be beneficial. And those two views have driven what has happened in some states. For example, a state like South Dakota enacted a law making it easier for teachers to bring guns to class under certain circumstances. Arkansas enacted a law allowing civilians to bring guns to churches and to college campuses under certain circumstances. Kentucky made it easier to get a concealed carry permit. And so that's symptomatic of the strength of gun rights forces in some of these states. On the other hand, you have a number of states like California, New York, Connecticut, Colorado, Massachusetts, Illinois, New Jersey, and others that have toughened their gun laws in various ways, pertaining to background checks, pertaining to restrictions on assault weapons, pertaining to other matters that have been discussed quite a bit. So you see the states really going in two different directions, and it is very much a consequence of the politics of this issue that it drives each side of the debate in a certain respect closer to its base rather than looking for a middle ground.
Lisa Miller, in your conversations with people in Newtown, Sandy Hook, as they watched what happened and did not happen in the year following their terrible losses, maybe there were many perspectives there as well. I mean, we're told this was an area with, you know, plenty of hunters there, plenty of Republicans and conservatives there, perhaps there are Second Amendment supporters even in the face of this. But did you hear Newtown saying the country has responded appropriately, adequately to our loss or not, Lisa?
You know, it's a very touchy subject in Newtown. I was surprised at how touchy a subject it is. There are some members of the families who really have been activists and advocating for stricter gun laws. Mm-hmm. But there are many families who live there who, as you say, are hunters, who have legal guns, who are Second Amendment advocates. And, you know, even the Catholic priest whom I talked to in town refused to take a position on gun control and gun laws. I found that a lot. People didn't want to stake out a position on gun laws. So they would say things like, yes, stricter gun laws, but also more mental health care for people who need it. You know, they were very, very unwilling to take a strong position on gun control in Newtown. And I think it's because of the demographics of the town. You know, it's a moderate conservative town, and a lot of people have guns, and they don't see stricter gun laws necessarily as the only or obvious solution.
Reverend Pollack, what about in your community? Do you hear people saying, we took this terrible loss and from it we got nothing nationally, and state by state it's actually swung toward looser gun regulation? Or we're coming to some more nuanced understanding of the problem, the threat, the crisis maybe?
I hear all sorts of things. Certainly I personally took a strong position in favor of the Connecticut law, although, again, I felt a lot of tension because I was hearing from parishioners and other people in the community who are gun owners talking about not wanting to infringe on their rights, not wanting to violate the Second Amendment. That tension is definitely there. I think there's a lot of people who look at certainly the federal debate over gun reform and say, how do we not capitalize on this tragedy in Newtown and at least get universal background checks? I hear that a lot.
Robert Spitzer, the big theme that came up alongside this, and we're seeing it today, Vice President Joe Biden announcing new push to increase access to mental health services. They tried to do this with Congress, couldn't, but they've put together $100 million in government spending to look at mental health services. Somehow this came so strongly to the fore. I mean, the NRA pushing more guns for citizens to defend themselves or teachers to, or others to defend schools, and this new scale of attention to mental health or to gun violence as a public health issue rather than a gun issue. How do you read that, Robert?
Well, I think that's a very important part of this burgeoning debate. Clearly, one of the things we know about mass shootings, and by way of background, it's important to say that mass shootings even now are relatively rare events and account for a very, very, very small percentage of gun violence in a given year. And, of course, that's, no comfort. That's,
I mean, we've had 16 or more since Newtown. That doesn't sound like
more
a small
than that.
Number. Yeah.
That's true. No, more than that, in fact. Still, I mean, it's important first to kind of keep perspective on this. Nevertheless, when mass shootings occur, one of the things we know is that a majority of those shootings in the last 30 years, at least, have been committed by people who clearly had mental health issues, significant mental health issues, as reported by friends and family. And so there is very much in the minds of public policymakers and others, a notion that more could be done and needs to be done to interdict, first to help people with mental health issues, while noting that 95% of people with diagnosable mental health issues do not have violence problems, but that means you have a 5% that do. And one of the things you would want to do would be to sever the link between people with significant mental health issues that are connected to violence and access to guns. Secondly, you also want to help people who have mental health problems generally, and the mental health system is very large, very porous. It's not well coordinated. Data even now is not properly and fully reported within states and to the national government. So in terms of reporting, in terms of interdiction, in terms of helping people with mental health issues more effectively, clearly more can be done and should be done. And I think that's the point that Vice President Biden was getting to.
Though it's a new complexion to this conversation. Really interesting that we would go there. Of course, the NRA, here was Executive VP Wayne LaPierre there. After the shootings, attacked the media, attacked video games and politicians who wanted to control guns, and offered this memorable solution to the problem, arming school staff with guns. Wayne LaPierre.
The only way to stop a monster from killing our kids is to be personally involved and invested in a plan of absolute protection. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Boy, that got a lot of people talking, but here we are, still no national response. Let's turn to our listeners. Robert in Burlington, Vermont. Thank you for calling. You're on the air, Robert.
Well, it's unbelievable after this year. No expanded background check, no magazine limit on magazine size, no nothing, really, as far as I can tell. And after Columbine, after Newtown, after several other towns that I can't even remember their names, it just seems apparently that we as a nation were willing to sacrifice our children on the altar of the Second Amendment. And it's just unbelievable to me. Unbelievable.
I mean, in some critics would say that we have literally done that in this case, and yet here we stand. Robert, thank you for your call. One more right here. Duluth, Minnesota. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. When I start talking to people about guns, I like to push the argument to a logical extreme. And I've asked many people this question. I say to them, would you feel more comfortable if everybody in this country had a gun or if nobody in this country had a gun? And only one person has said, I would feel more comfortable if everybody had a gun. And then I asked them, which direction do you think we're headed? And we all know which direction we're headed in. The second point I'd like to make is that the people who are making money, the arms industries, the pawn shops that sell guns, arms sellers everywhere, the gun shops, people who are making money on it should not have a voice in what happens in the gun laws. If you're making money on it, they should not be able to say and influence with the money and power that they have to influence what's happening to us in this country.
And yet, of course, they can and do through contributions to organizations and much more. Michael in Duluth, thank you for your call. So, Robert Spitzer, what about this mental health angle? You've studied gun violence for a long time. The recommendation out just this week is from some is to look at this as a public health issue. It's quite a different approach, I think, from a gun control issue. Are people turning in this direction because we're in a stalemate over gun laws? Are they turning in this direction because it's doable? There was Adam Lanza alone in his room. The guns he used were his mother's, legally bought. Are we really going to find him out before something like this happens?
That's a good question. You cannot find every Adam Lanza that there is. However, there are places in the country, such as New York State, where if you want to obtain a gun yourself, and Lanza, of course, as you pointed out, obtained guns from his mother, and clearly those guns were accessible to him, which goes to the question of gun safety and storage at home. But clearly you want to do everything you can to sever the link between people who have significant mental health issues and firearms. And one way you can do that is by having an effective background check system. As one of the callers noted, Congress failed to enact a uniform system of background checks this past spring. And that's notable because between 30 and 40% of all gun sales in America, by various estimates, occur without any background check because they do not occur between citizens and a licensed firearms dealer who is required to conduct a background check. And that is indeed a gaping hole that even great majorities of gun owners agree is a hole that should be filled. And pertaining to background checks, as I started to say, some states have quite rigorous systems. Here in New York State, for example, when you apply for a pistol permit, you have to submit the names of four character references, and local police authorities will contact those references and will ask them, well, what do you think about this person? And if the police have any reason to believe that the person might have problems, ought not to have a gun, whether they're felons or not, whether they have any formally diagnosed issues or not, the state has the discretion to say, no, we're not going to grant a pistol permit. And that's a system that there's good reason to believe is more effective at keeping guns away from people who shouldn't have them than what is done in most states where it's pretty easy to get a pistol permit and therefore a pistol.
So that's kind of going at the edges. But as you say, the majority of states have actually gone to more lenient gun laws in the aftermath of this. And we saw the rush to buy guns in the aftermath of this just out of the fear of Second Amendment abridgments in the eyes of those going after those guns, Bob.
Well, it is, I think, in equal or greater measure a political statement by people. One reason people go out and buy more guns after, for example, after the election or re-election of President Obama or after a shooting was to make a political point. Look, I want to have guns. It's my right to have them. And also I want to get them before they become illegal if that happens.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about grief and guns 1 year after the Sandy Hook school shootings. The long conversation, hard conversation, propelled again by Newtown's nightmare. Robert Spitzer is with us. He's a leading expert on gun control. He joins us from the University of New York at Cortland with us today from Ithaca, New York. Reverend Josh Pollack is here, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut, up the road from Newtown. And Lisa Miller is here from New York Magazine. She's written in depth about the community and its struggle to find its feet in long months after last year's killing. All kinds of response. Mina says, life trumps gun rights. Maybe. Not in the last year exactly, not in our political conversation. Bonita says, I've realized that if gun laws can't be strengthened after the massacre of 20 small children, she says white children, she says, then they probably never will. Coast says, leave it to our media to tell us that the Newtown shootings were chiefly or all about gun ownership. This listener doesn't by that. John in Glastonbury, Connecticut. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah,
I'm a gun owner, have been for many, many years, and I live in Connecticut. I had relatives living in Sandy Hook at the time of the shooting, and fortunately, my nieces and nephews are at St. Rose's down the street. And this tragedy has certainly affected me.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that it took me 3 months to get a license to carry in Connecticut prior to the shooting at Newtown. And I've got law enforcement training. I was qualified on, you know, the AR-15 for mm-hmm. law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, joined the Smith & Wesson Academy and still needed to pass another gun safety course before my chief would allow me to have a license to carry. So very, very strict gun laws. And, you know, the conversation really ignores, I heard you talking about the gun culture. We've had semi-automatic weapons in this country for 60 years. So we didn't have the shooting 60 years ago. We used to have gun clubs at high schools. Something has changed. And the longer we talk about guns and equate guns with these tragedies, it's a diversion. We're avoiding the true conversation and what's causing people to do the types of things that they're doing. And if our citizens are not prepared to respond, these acts all occur in gun-free zones. And there's a reason for that. And there's a Harvard study out that I don't hear talked about on NPR and other media sources that says that, you know, the common, you know, belief that less, you know, less guns equals less crime is false. Massachusetts passed assault weapons ban, and contrary to every other state in the country, you know, their crime increased. So I would love a discussion, a real frank discussion based, you know, that's data driven to talk about the real issues if we're going to honor the victims of Newtown.
I mean, John, I think everybody's open to the idea that culture changes, things have changed, there are tensions or writing in our culture that may lead to part of this. But still, it's that gun in the hand of Adam Lanza that allowed him to kill so many in such a little handful of minutes. I mean, thank heavens your niece was at a different school, but that's kind of the luck of the draw, isn't it?
Oh, most certainly. But, you know, you're not going to prevent that. And by making it harder for law-abiding folks to protect themselves, you're not going to, you know, put your head in the sand and say, oh, you know, if we you know, pass these gun laws, everybody's going to be safe. That's just a fallacy.
Well, I mean, I take your point. You say let's be data-driven. Of course, the data on murder and even mass killing in this country is pretty bad compared to many others. But I take your point, John. Let me get one more, if I may. Mike in Salem, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I have to agree with Reverend Pollock, I think, who said that this is really a cultural issue. And if we're going to have a cultural issue, we need a cultural change. I think right now that the politics are actually getting in the way, and that both sides are so entrenched on the gun debate issue that they're not listening to each other and they're seeing each other as evil. I think that both sides, I'm a gun control advocate, and I believe that gun control advocates need to listen to the fears of the gun of the gun people,
mm-hmm.
In the sense that they're afraid that their Second Amendment rights are going to be taken away. They're afraid that their hunting traditions are going to be taken away. And most important, the people who we should listen to are those gun owners, I think, who teach their children responsible gun use, etc. These people shouldn't be demonized. Instead, we should be listening to them, quelling their fears, so that reasonable discussion can take place and real gun control and cultural change can happen.
And you're saying that as a gun reform, gun control activist. That's very interesting, Mike, and I appreciate your call. Lisa Miller, some of this theme in the conversation in the past year seems to have been born out of Newtown itself, as some of these groups out of Newtown that came together to talk about gun law took a very public kind of nuanced stance here. It wasn't necessarily about mass reform. There was this element of let's go moderately here. Or did I mishear, Lisa?
No, I think that's right. I mean, there was a group called Sandy Hook Promise that really does take a sort of moderate way through this, where they say we want, you know, gun reform, but we also want to talk about mental health, and we also want to talk about parenting. I mean, they make a big push to talk about how do we be good parents to our children and how do we get the kinds of support we need? Because one of the things people in Newtown talk about is, you know, how did nobody know that this kid was so troubled, including his own mother? How is it possible that he ended up killing the child of somebody who lived across the street from him and she never knew that he was living across the street from her and that he was so troubled? So, yes, there are groups that are taking this middle path, but I think the politics, as you say, are very, very difficult. But because as somebody in Newtown said to me in one of our conversations, really, when it comes down to it, if you're Republican, you talk about mental health, and if you're Democrat, you talk about gun control.
Yeah.
So this emphasis on mental health is, I think, by the vice president, is an effort to find a middle way. And I want to say one other thing, which is that in all of the political conversations, the particulars of Adam Lanza don't raise any flags. His mother took pride in teaching him about gun safety. She took him to the shooting range legally. She boasted about how her guns were locked up, etc. And nobody in his world, including his own mother, thought of him as violent. And so he wouldn't
clearly
have
troubled.
Raised,
I mean, we're reading he communicated
troubled,
with
yes,
his mother inside
children,
the house only by text messages and
yes,
email. I don't know if that's true.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, clearly he was troubled. And, you know, it's hard to blame this poor mother who ended up dead in her bed. But obviously she wasn't interpreting warning signs carefully enough. But at the same time, you know, psychologists he saw, therapists he saw, nobody raised the flag of violence. His mother told a friend that she wasn't afraid of him. And so would he have, you know, would he have set off any alarms in a system that was more scrupulous about mental health? I don't know.
I mean, that is a good and vivid question, though, because those kids are dead. Sherry in Boston, Massachusetts. Sherry, you're on the air.
I became active in Massachusetts post Newtown. Clearly impacted me in a way that this was it was my backyard.
Yeah.
But I work in the city of Boston, and the daily urban violence had really been an issue for me for a long time, and I think that's missing from the conversation. I've been organizing with the Massachusetts Coalition to close some of the loopholes in Massachusetts law, but I think one caller said, you know, the deaths have gone up from guns in Massachusetts. Well, part of that is the illegal gun trafficking, and most of the illegal guns come into Massachusetts from New Hampshire and Maine. They don't have good background checks.
Mm-hmm.
Massachusetts does. And
that's the whole point of the push for national law, right?
Yes,
so you don't have a patchwork.
That is why, and I think the conversation has to deal with the politics and the money. Another caller said it. The National Rifle Association gets millions of dollars from gun manufacturers. And there was a change back in the 70s, I think, in the leadership. Many NRA members from surveys say they support background checks. But the leadership has lobbied hard. And in Massachusetts, there's an organization, state organization, GOAL, Gun Owners Action League. They have a lobbyist in the State House every day. Every week they get emails. That is their single issue. And so the level of organization, the level of funding that's gone into the gun control, that whips people up. I see it. I get their news. It whips people up that the government wants to go into your house and take the gun away. And they have. They've manipulated the Second Amendment, you know, right.
I mean,
so I think the universal background checks that all the national key organizations say that would go very far, not eliminate everything, not all issues. But I think the mental health focus is crucial in its own terms, not just for, you know, for gun violence, but it's not the central issue. And the public health argument, Dr. David Hemenway makes it, public health looks upstream. Where does the problem come from? When there's E. coli in spinach, they don't just go to the grocery store.
Yep.
Who produced it? Where does it come from? And that's the issue about the guns. It's not the person who shot the gun on the street. Where did they buy it? Where did they get it? Where does the gun come from? And it is dealers, and it is the gun shows, and it is the manufacturers. Their interest is to sell more guns.
Well, I take your point, Sherry. I mean, when you look upstream there, you're saying, let's look up the supply chain on the gun side. On the other hand, you're going to have people on the mental health issue. When they look upstream, they're thinking back to the origins of violence. Well, you get into deep philosophical waters there. Reverend Pollack, When you look at how this conversation has changed in this country in the aftermath of this terrible shooting, do you see this conversation maturing? Do you see it ducking the issue? Do you see it rationalize? What?
I think it's doing all those things. I have a couple thoughts on this. First, the idea that violence, particularly gun violence, is a public health crisis is really not a new one. We've been talking about that for a long time in Hartford. And the way I think about that is not so much about the illegal weapons coming into our inner cities, although that's important. It's that when there's a shooting on a city street and someone's murdered or even injured, you can count on in a dense urban area about 50 kids walking by the yellow tape and developing some level of post-traumatic stress mm-hmm. disorder following that. And it's not, in general, being treated. And when this compounds over years of witnessing violence and, again, not being treated, and then you add in poverty and other issues, we have a public health crisis on our hands. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing is back to the culture. I actually haven't seen the culture change. And I love what I'm reading on the Sandy Hook Promise website about parenting. Lisa mentioned that. But as I read it, it's not just parenting our own children. It's parenting all children. And they're urging people in their own communities to think very deeply about how we interact not only with our own children, but with the children of other families. And one of the things I hoped to see by now, although I haven't really seen it yet, is a very robust conversation along those lines. How can we be in other children's lives? I think there's actually a cultural status quo that doesn't want other parents connecting with the children of other families. But I think that's essential. I think that's one of the ways we keep kids who are going to fall through the cracks from falling through the cracks.
Robert Spitzer, we just have half a minute here, but you've followed this for such a long time. What do you see in this year? Is the country getting in gear towards some kind of credible response, or is it floundering, spinning its wheels on this?
Well, I think it's moving moving ahead in fits and starts, mostly at the states. But let me just bring together a few of the points that have been raised here. Yeah. One is that there have been several recent studies which note that there's a direct correlation between how strict the gun laws of a state are and its crime rate. So states that have the strictest gun laws have the lowest crime rates, and states that have the most lax gun laws have the highest crime rates. Mm-hmm. Secondly, violence has many causes, and if you took away guns tomorrow, there would still be violence. However, guns are uniquely efficient at wreaking violence, and that's why you want to sever that link. And I got one other point to make, but I'll hold it.
Robert Spitzer, author of the forthcoming Guns Across America, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Reverend Josh Pawlik at the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut. Reverend Pawlik, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lisa Miller, contributing editor at New York Magazine. You can read her story, Orders of Grief, going deeply into the community's response after its tragedy last year. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
In a moment, the voices of Newtown parents. This is On Point. For the moment, the most part, the people of Newtown have asked the media and the nation to leave them alone to their sorrow, their remembrance on this Saturday's anniversary of the killings. They've said, go out and do good in your own community. But on Monday, some of the parents and family of the 26 Newtown shooting victims spoke before cameras to remember those they have lost.
Our family will be lighting a candle on the eve of 12/14, the last night we spent with our sweet Charlotte.
And we will be lighting a candle for our beautiful little girl, Jessica.
We will be lighting a candle on behalf of Jesse McCord Lewis.
We're going to light a candle in honor of our daughter, Emily.
We will light a candle for my mom, Dawn Hochsprung. We will light a candle for my older sister, Victoria.
We will be lighting a candle for my sweet boy, Jack.
We
will be lighting a candle in honor of our beautiful girl, Grace.
We will be lighting a candle for our gorgeous daughter, Aviel.
We'll be lighting a candle for our beautiful daughter, Anna.
Vamos a prender una vela para Anna.
We will be lighting a candle for our sweet son, Daniel.
We'll be lighting a candle for my daughter, Lauren.
We will light a candle for Jace.
We will be lighting a candle for our irrepressible Benny.
That's a lot of candles. Families there in Newtown this week, remembering those they lost a year ago. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.